Thursday, April 29th, 2020, County Members Present, Power Representative Grant's story. Grant's story is already in the structure's files. We have a room to conduct business in the Department of Transportation. Since the result of all those records is social equity and being willing to adjourn that to all the others in the room that you're being involved in. Then committing your duties to legislation so you can update appropriate share limits. First up is the Water Dining and Transition Resolution 5, proposing amendments to the Constitution of the State of Alaska relating to appropriation of income relating to the Budget Reserve Fund. The committee will also hear a contraction of how that is going to be HB 141, accumulating to an appropriation limit. Before we begin on each presentation, I think it's our honor to go to the committee. The role we will see for ONB today applies to both HDR 1 and 141, but those are substantially similar, so keep that in mind as you look at the projections and look at the information sets that applies to both bills. While the two approaches to the updating appropriation limit are different, there are some significant differences, which Megan Strickland's fully will detail on ONB's presentation. And with that, I want to go ahead and bring up the Australian and Carolyn Schultz, the Media Officer and the Admin Budget, to present their constitutional amendment.
Good morning, for the record, we are signed to correct our office of budget amendment.
Good morning, President Schultz, please be with us for the office of budget amendment.
Thank you for inviting us here today to present on HDR 6, the Governor's constitutional amendment to address the spending limit and constitutional budget reserve. So, a little bit about why we're presenting a change to the constitutional budget reserve and the constitutional spending limit. And this is the sort of drawdown of savings, as you can certainly be familiar with, that I included in almost every presentation I give, just for framing of how we got to where we are today. The state, over the last roughly decade, has spent down over $16 billion in budget reserves through expenditures and excess of revenue. A lot of those expenditures were run up when we had excess revenues and increased state spending to match those increases in state revenues that resulted in a level of state spending that was not able to be adjusted downward as revenue came down. Our constitutional spending limit and many of the other constitutional spending limits that have been proposed seek to address the issue of that ability to run up state spending at an unsustainable rate.
And before you move on, I just want to recognize that Representative Beeson joined us on number 348.
So, to more clearly lay out about the issue with the current constitutional spending limit, which is what you're seeing in the dark blue, black line, is what the current constitutional spending limit is. You can see that that line started right at a level close to the media spending back at its inception in 1982, but it has escalated far greater than spending. So the limit is set currently in the Constitution isn't really effective at controlling gross spending because it grew too fast to actually be effective and implementable. You can see in the yellow line here, which reflects EGF revenues, that there really are only 2 years in the history of our current constitutional spending limit where there was even sufficient revenue to spend to that limit. You can also see that the dotted line is just way on the HDR 6 spending limit if it had been enacted in 1982. Giving you an idea of how it works a little bit differently to effectively constrain spending.
And if any of some historical context, the early 1980s, when the constitutional spending law was originally ratified by the voters, it contained a provision that in 5 years they would have to be accepted, and the voters would have to approve it a second time. And in 1986, the voters were off the constitutional spending limit, and I saw the staff, and you can see even earning the late 1980s, 1986, and I already was earning well above the level of spending at the time. But bonus, despite that, still ratified it. The constitutional funding limit, and so has been voted up a few times. That's also a statutory spending limit. But what he says as well, but I just want to point out that the comfortable spending limit is something that's really prevalent in the last 1 year. It was not the leader's bank. It's a thing that people have already had approved at least.
Talking a little bit more about the engineer assets itself, so it looks like if you're really seeking to fix that current calculation, one way that we're seeking to fix that calculation is to change the base by which you look at the spending limits calculated off of to adjust to be a may not exceed the prior 3 year average compounded by the greater of inflation or population growth. The current constitutional spending limit has a base set in 1982 that's escalated by inflation and population growth compounded. So we're changing basically the adjustment factor or the escalator of the constitutional spending limit as well as the base to which that is applied. We also clarify that information of appropriations subject to the cap. So it includes appropriations of state funds, both EGF and DGF. But it excludes a couple of appropriations. It excludes the permit fund dividend. It excludes expenditures of bond proceeds as well as debt service for bonds. It excludes deposits and district savings bonds. And it excludes digital for response spending. And then also main state funds that are for specific purposes of the funds and revenues community. And it excludes some from that calculation spending. HDR 6 also amends Article 9, Section 17 of the American Constitution. That section is the Constitutional Budget Reserve, with the limited activist provision to that appropriation through the CPR by majority vote only if it's enacted the general fund revenues to be expenditures. It also removes the general fund liability to the CPR and what is known as the CPR sweep. So the table here gives a couple of or a comparison between the current spending limit and the proposed constitutional amendment. That lays out what's different between the two. And when you look at that black box, you think, well, both the items, some of the items different than the exclusion. The current limit excludes revenues from the public enterprise and some capital appropriations. Those exclusions are not included in HDR 6. But in HDR 6, we've excluded other state savings accounts. Deposits into other state savings accounts and then pursuing deposits into the permanent fund. The base, you see the base in the current constitutional spending limit is $2.5 billion, which we set in 1982 with that earlier graph you saw with rather than a spending at the time. The base in HDR 6 is an average of the previous 3 years, which allows that base to adjust the spending decisions. And you'll see the modeling and later slides of how that works and why we chose to reduce 3 year average. And then also changes, as I mentioned earlier, the adjuster factors rather than compounding inflation and population, which you can see in the current limit has a very high growth rate. Instead, we go to greater than inflation and population. And we have some modeling that's later in the slide that gives you an idea of how that works and the different types of adjusters that you can see done when you're looking at spending limits. So, moving on to a little bit of the modeling, I'm going to pass it over to policy analyst.
Thank you for your effort again, Caroline Schultz. Three important policy considerations when talking about the response to the spending limit. The first is what is included in the effects of the spending limit. And these kinds of decisions are those really important policy decisions that really are built upon what kind of spending and what kind of exclusions the legislature. this graph shows, you can see the blue dotted lines reflect what your scenario is if each year 6 of the 3 moon average had been implemented in particular. So the first one, the light moon line, started off in 2000, went up like 5 at the time. At the 5:15, you can see that depending on when the moon would have been implemented or initiated, depending on the level of spending in red, they would have started at really different levels. Of course, you know, this year 15 was taking into account the highest number of funding years, you know, fiscal year 13, 14, and 15. Taking this into account to establish the cap, you can see that the spending limit with the dark blue dotted line starts way high, but because based on our 3-year moving average, it adjusts down back to the spending level. So it permits the flexibility to react to the real fiscal conditions. It prevents essentially the runaway of we've seen with the current article in section 16 above the blue dotted line, the dark blue dotted line mentioned earlier, which is something that we've never really even ever had to think about. So we move to the next slide. And I think if I'm talking about those four examples, as I think it's going to be HR 6 in the government years, and instead of using the 3 moving average, the dotted line in the same color reflects you know, if you had just started with the prior year as a fixed base and run from there. And of course, you can see the same thing happens as it does with the current constitutional limit, because there's no way for the spending limit to really adjust down given fiscal realities. It has to grow according to whatever your estimator is, and in this case, it's population or inflation, whatever the rater is. So you can see using the moving average concept as your base year allows for flexibility. Unnecessary construction that had been deferred So this slide talks a lot about forecasting, and this is a little bit uninteresting slide if you look at it. And what I really want to do here is outline the difficulty in forecasting a spending limit that is based on the average, because not only do you have to predict economic conditions like population growth and inflation, you also have to predict future spending, which of course is known as very difficult. So what I'm going to outline here, the red line reflects an only 10-year plan of future spending, which, you know, of course, is based on a number of assumptions about revenue cuts, expenditure cuts, as well as expenditure growth. But it is again, it's just one potential reality. And then the gray dotted line, and I'm part of the dream of this question, I think are a little bit hard to see, but the lower back line, which is a lighter color gray, that shows the spending cap. If spending follows the OMB 10-year plan. So you can see eventually that that cap catches up with spending, which makes sense because the OMB 10-year plan in that years is based on inflation assumptions that are the same as the inflation assumptions I used here. The darker dotted line, the black dotted line, reflects precisely the maximum potential spending cap under HTR 6 given the CPI assumption of 2.5% population growth assumption. And those are assumptions that the dark dotted line is really the true max spending cap given its economic realities. Domestic product, which is the value of all goods and services produced in Alaska. sort of simple partial projections based on different spending. And the main idea here is different projections where you hold spending constant and allow for a different population and inflation scenarios. The blue line shows that we experienced the same kind of inflation as was experienced in the 1980s. So you can see our blue dots ratchet the spending a little bit higher because inflation value is somewhat higher. It also shows a hyperinflation scenario based on the Department of Labor's core prices. The orange line in the middle is if inflation had up to the 2000s, which was the lower inflation period. The blue line shows that if we go up to the 2010, inflation usually gets to the lowest inflation of all of these projections. So essentially what we're trying to show here is that different economic considerations will change your spending behavior based on
population. Necessary investment in deferred maintenance that you need to consider if you look at operating budgets and capital budgets, and also operating budgets for operating maintenance going forward. We think that HDO sets in the flexibility a lot because it's over 3 year average and because it does allow for some escalation, but also allow for some amount of response, just not, large investment. But it does allow for the use of general obligation bond debt. Larger needs, if there is a immediate larger need, there is still that option to address some of those capital expenditure costs. So we don't see necessarily as completely limiting the ability to respond to current need, but more just constraining out of control gross and in spending for not necessary purposes.
Always picked up a question I had, which is, how do we address deferred maintenance in future years? Should we see the price of oil and skyrocket to $80 or $100 a barrel? And, you mentioned that there is some flexibility. It does ramp up to some extent, but it kind of ramps up over time. But you could also take out all the different ones that also see a situation in which oil prices rise and up, reflect the savings funds that didn't know or early action to actually address deferred maintenance, which I think is a very serious issue. It could be take out bonds that go into debt and you have savings on the beginning. And that can create somewhat of an awkward situation. So I don't know if you need to comment on that unless you'd like to, but it just seems odd to me that you could end up in a situation where we go into debt despite having savings.
That is a very important policy consideration in setting a spending limit because, by its nature, we're looking to constrain the ability to respond to increased revenue. To avoid that boom and bust cycle that sequence has seen. But as you're picking up on, there are some that need to make deferred maintenance where either there may be a justifiable or some set of need, such as meeting the state facilities, that there would be a desire to spend on. But equally, when there is that revenue, there's a desire to spend on things that are not necessary. And so, it's very hard to make a value judgment of what types of spending are planning, which time came in talking about the exemptions to the spending cut. But things like deferred maintenance, that's a policy consideration. Obviously, you're considering different spending caps. It's how to care for the necessary spending versus frivolous spending. Obviously, revenue, of course.
Thank you.
Yeah,
the as well as the administration to consider. All right, I'm Representative Hanson, Representative Easton.
Thank you for response. Spending cap includes programs to balance both designated funds
at this meeting, reference the inspection crew and official boats and turbo ticket. And that was for the VAT. This one potentially restrict the growth of those owners where we started. Well, we started to implement a park fee to pay for state parks. This would limit the growth of that, would it not? Or is there a way around it?
Susan Clare, excellent approach. It would limit the growth of fees that come into that general fund if it was outside of the adjuster factors that we've put in place. The general fund, whether there's fees or general tax revenue, it is still kind of general fund. That's why we've included this in the case of the distinction between the two from a, let's say, fiscal perspective is really just there for a tracking mechanism. So we are looking to constrain the ability to generate new programs when there is additional revenue to avoid the revenue spending to be able to have a record spending cap. But this one, it's up to the creation of a new fee based program.
Yeah.
But
the city of Fairbanks and the Fairbanks Transport Bureau have revenue caps. Ordinance run by the city charter, and it limits the amount of revenue that they can take in to property tax valuation growth, more or less. And the city ran into the problem that the burg, it's not the asset map problem for the burg. It's not a problem for the citizens, but the burg, because the burg has expanded its property tax base. So, burg didn't have to be affected. The city was constrained. There hasn't been that much property tax growth. And so the city has got around that. I don't mean that as nefarious as a chance, but they are charging more fees direct for the services, building inspections, electrical inspections, etc. So that's why I've looked at it. My thought for growing everyone is relying on fees rather than taxes. And so this might be the way of that theory of allowing government to grow this time. Yeah, great, thank you, Richard. At the end of the day, you spoke of the deferred maintenance and consider a prudential liability. What impact, if any, will the state order have on legal liability, such as pension obligations and other things that are immediate or more legally required?
The chair representative Eastman, so looking at the exemptions for the spending cap include deposits into state savings cap, which I believe I understand include deposits into the pension fund, the ERS fund, or the CARES fund. So it would have constrained our ability to meet those specific obligations. And it wouldn't constrain our ability to meet obligations such as paying down state debt or other things of that nature. We're looking to constrain spending on discretionary items and constrain the rest of extra government spending, extra programs being created, and not hamper the ability for the state to meet existing and constitutional obligations such as bank or retirement.
So, in my instance, we're able to decide to pay another $2 billion towards pension obligations. Would that $2 billion then just left out towards the spending that particular year? Or would it be a situation where if we spent the $2 billion first on the dividend and spending some type of other appropriation later in the year?
You kind of represent an easement, or the superintendent, it wouldn't count towards the spending.
subject to the cap as, you know, the cap as applied by the Constitution.
We also have Assistant Attorney General Bill Knox, the program on the right hand of the card, address that question in more detail about the opportunities then. Mr. Knox, did you hear the question?
Yes, Madam Chair, question that I heard about concerning graduate school, which I would agree with, if that could support.
I think that's a really good question, and probably a question we might have to run from the terms of the analysts. I'm sure there are people that are obviously busy debating on finance, and so we will take back to the question about their neighbor. I think that's a really great question. All right, and we're going to push over to the jury.
To respond to all of this, I think about our constitutional obligations here, and I have a dream that we will be the top education state offering that to American students. And when I think about the exact fund and our obligations since 2017 and our base of operations, we need to try to know from cost of living our teachers are caught in the middle of the gap corners, and that is our number one. This day in the school, indicator of how school boarding will be when we have not a retirement system. And we don't have that defined by the demand behind contribution. It takes quite a few things. And what I found saying that money is everything that will make us to the top education state, and we can plan it all with how you use your monies. I think it's very realistic that we are not top in our employees, our teachers, our staff, what they should be paying. As a hardest bet, if we decide in the next year that should make a major adjustment in an area, it could be another one that we feel is critically important. How does this account for our constitutional obligations and increase in those? More than inflation, I'm just going to say.
I'm 15 representative story. Education quoting similar to the answer on the firm and spoken because of us subject listening, you know, the cap as we've heard in age 36, it will be all, you know, essentially compete for that availability of the expenditure on positive Catholic education is within that cap. So we're also looking at trying to the escalation of the spending limit and its primary condition is on that. So as you reach the expenditure limit, you have to reallocate priorities within that on the statewide budget process. But we don't include that as an exemption to the grant in this draft.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you. Could you elaborate more on how bonding would fit into this? One of the ways we can still address deferred maintenance would be a bond issue, maybe. But would there be a limit on the amount of bonds that you could issue, or is that just above the top?
Issuing general obligation bond debt and expending the proceeds of a bond sale as well as paying the debt service aren't subject to the type as costly. Those have that other constraint in that they have to go to a vote of the people. So there is that constraint and the agreement of the people to issue that debt and fund those projects, and so it isn't subject to the type.
Essentially, if the voters approve the general obligation bond, the spending cap will be raised appropriately to pay the interest on those bonds.
Through the chair, Representative Cox, it just simply wouldn't be part of the calculation of the spending cap. So the cap itself would be raised, but that expenditure wouldn't be subject to the spending cap. Effectively, the answer is yes, but the technical details are.
Thank you so much,
Jeremy. I'm trying to deal in reality in most cases, but I think this is public education, so it seems to be happening. If I just
which I can see like off the hill. Many campuses is pretty firm. There's really no way around it. We constantly try to go to the people who are involved in the campus. We've talked about the mechanism for the spending cap to increase over time. It depends on the age of the growth of the population. I wonder how our money will figure to see on the public level move it. I'd like to refer to the last one we have a two-year legislature, for example, set appropriations at a very low level. Say, just to get our majority, you want to set them in the 1990 levels. What kind of impact is that going to have on future legislation that comes afterwards? So is there any remedies or for the next set of legislators that have been voted in to correct that spending level, or would you see that spending cap just severely, bottom out and then spending to unreasonable levels for future years?
Effectively, with a three-year average, if you could drive down, you would tap and get 2 weeks spending as it declines. So if there was a conscious decision to significantly reduce spending over time, it would bring this spending limit down a little bit.
I guess moving on to the fair state, though, if you could arbitrarily drive that spending cap down, the only mechanism for bringing it back up is the rate of inflation or population growth. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I know it's a little bit of a wild idea and something that hopefully happened, but when you consider something as serious as a constitutional amendment, constitutional spending cap, I think it's important to map out certain scenarios and make sure that we don't end up in a situation where a state is really not strongly unable to adapt to whatever it comes with.
Sure, I'd bring it back to that. Governor Fauci, the quote that we have here with the National Treasury Laboratory, originally when he said it is going to be much smaller level, whether or not that would have been, isn't something that I consider directly, but something that I have been thinking about very again with regard to this. It's not an abstract idea, it's something that there is certainly an influx of available federal funds that can be used to reduce your budget, on paper, but it's just exactly the situation that we're in. So if the legislature, whether it's in 1 year, decided to replace, $1 billion of state funding, or $500 million of state funding in 1 year after another for next, then that would push down the spending cap. That's an issue that is immediately present and something that we've been considering ready to prepare for that. So I would say that, maybe the first scenario is perhaps far-fetched, the possibility of being able to replace state funds with federal funds is something we're dealing with right now.
Along similar lines, federal funding is a situation in which the federal government really wants to invest in upgrading our renewable power, utility infrastructure, and renewables or other investments that are state that requires a state match, and an inability to be able to break the appropriate the funds to meet that match or so, Mr. Patterson, kind of having all these different scenarios that we might end up in, I think it's important to consider how this would play into all of these different scenarios. So, appreciate the input and thought into this.
All right. One more
point, perhaps. Let's look at the change to the constitutional budget reserve fits into this. Spending cap on the for this line of printers we'll see there. Slide 5.
Mr. DeGeneres, the changes made to the Constitutional Budget Reserve in 306 change the way that Constitutional Budget Reserve can be accessed. So rather than requiring a strict quarter vote in these circumstances, it instead allows a majority vote, but only in a situation where there are inadequate revenues to meet expenditures.
It also renews the Galvin liability to CDR, the three provisions which are currently in place.
It doesn't quite turn into the same mechanism as the statutory budget reserve that's currently on the books.
No, it doesn't turn it quite into the same thing, but it certainly retains it as a constitutionally protected, effectively rainy day fund for situations which are not revenues or inadequate.
I think this is true that the designated funds that are swept back and forth would continue to exist if this is implemented within the Constitutional Budget Reserve Act.
So, Chair Representative Brax, because this removes the general fund liability and the senior fleet provisions, those designated general funds would remain managed as some funds of the general fund, so they will continue to exist.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions?
Thank you, Chair. So I see that the mechanism of authorizing expenditures from the fund are changed pretty much more in line with the general fund estimates for the legislators. But to make a formal objection, what are actually the distinctions after this passes between the general fund and the constitutional budget fund?
The Chair Representative, that's a really good question because it can be accessed by a simple majority vote. The expenditures from the CDR will be similar to a general fund expenditure in terms of the kind of required. However, the source of money into the CDR will be managed separately as a rainy day fund, so the first access would be general fund and general fund revenues in the current fiscal year. We'd only be able to do the CDR should that be inadequate to fund government purposes. So it's more of a segregating a rainy day fund rather than lobbying the bond to the general fund.
And since we're removing the requirement for this to be select back into the CDR, what do you envision the appropriate amount of the CDR being, if any? How much money should be in the CDR? How much money can be in the CDR if we're not requiring the previous borrowing to be repaid?
The deposits into the CDR will be similar to what they are now, with settlement income earnings on the fund itself. In terms of what the correct balance of the constitutional budget reserve is, that's kind of a major policy question that I think is a much broader discussion under this change. Its use will be similar in the current current short-term outlook where we're utilizing the CDR as the cash flow account for the state. For those purposes, we need roughly $4,500 million in an account to meet basic cash flow needs. So that's in perspective, the absolute minimum. For the purpose of general fund revenue volatility and being able to utilize the CDR to address those volatilities, that need under our current fiscal structure is sort of unbounded. When you look at that first slide, we had roughly $60 million in reserves, which have been drawn down completely because we haven't addressed the structural issues. So revenue volatility on our current structure, we can't really have an answer for what we need in a rainy day fund because we know that $60 million isn't enough. So until we really resolve some of those structural issues, giving them an answer to the right amount of money in our rainy day funds is very difficult.
Thank you.
interesting. Cap conversation is very interesting, but I think just as important, and also maybe more important, at this time also is the revenue conversation. And I certainly hope that the administration will come to the table with some restrictive revenue levels at some point in time. Actually, we don't need to, have no position on that at this point in time. The payment plan does identify that there's sort of $1 billion in new revenue moving forward, but if we don't have new revenue, we're going to start seeing potentially a bit of a drop in the earnings reserve, which was something that's taken from action to protect the rate share. And we can share with our committee. We certainly can't pay this one note, for the public that's marketing the CBR currently before this amendment, considering this amendment, which is already required to pre-order of this breakdown funds that we spent. Services and constitutionally mandated services, and we're also prepared with new revenue. And I think that that's an important area for the governor to take some leadership on moving forward. So you don't have to respond. But I feel like it's important to say that. Right. It looks like we've talked about opportunities questions on your constitutional amendment and very much appreciate your time today. Appreciate your mind. Do you have any closing remarks for that tonight?
All I would say is that, as was just noted in the chat, that this is one piece in the overall ability to address the social fiscal problems. And really, if we look at that executive concert with other considerations, like our DOMP constitutional amendment and other large structural fixes, because this on its own does not solve the problems it faces.
All right, do you have any comments? Yeah, this is the item that it's going to pick up by House Bill 145. Is there any comments? Is there a question?
I'm just going to comment. As you said, the chapter 15, this is not a policy concern. It is the other side of the picture. But over the last 4 years, government thought has been spent on revenue management rather than long-term spending trends, and that would be the advantage of this desire for, especially at state level, our revenue is so volatile, and this would, the biggest thing is it would provide stability over the long term for the base part of our government growing to what would be an unsustainable level without lots of other things. I mean, that's it.
About the value of a spending cap and whether a constitutional spending cap is the appropriate program or whether we want to potentially update our statutory spending cap. As we heard in the presentation from OMB, our current constitutional spending cap is the floor set in 1982. We've never bumped up to the spending cap in the history of the state in the last year. During the time we had the highest oil production prices in the history of our state. And the reason was because it was set in 1982 when spending
Thank you. short term deficit. I'm sure the general design budget for capital purchases averaged $123 million over the last 5 years, which is way too low to address the important deferred maintenance needs that we know that we have across the state of Alaska, including at the University of Alaska and our schools across the state. Further, as was referenced by Representative Story, we have increased education funding in years, and every year that we don't increase education funding to keep up with inflation, essentially operates as a cut. Our university system has been cut. We have real needs that we need to make sure that we pay for. However, as was noted by our friends at Melody, we have spent a lot of money in times when oil prices were very high. I would argue that always makes sense. We have a church in Anchorage which was developed as a fish processing plant, which is paid for by government funds. And I think it's a great example of why we are using an economical that includes for the price of when oil was high. We had a lot of cash going into the state of Alaska. We frankly, we didn't save enough money. We did save a lot of money in 2018 for that. And that's such a lot of money standards for in addition to spending money. But we also spent a lot of money on capital projects, which in my view are the most prudent use of that fund. And we didn't use that opportunity to dramatically increase the purpose of the permanent fund in ways that I think would be advantageous for us. This committee has advanced very conservative fiscal policy designed to prevent the permanent fund from being overspent. But we also need to advance fiscal policy that we can ensure increases the amount of funds that go to the permanent fund so we can build back to that $100 billion asset, which our state needs strategically moving forward. So, we heard a publication on a constitutional spending cap. We also heard, I think, really important questions from members of the committee about the risks and the dangers of a constitutional spending cap that is too hard set for spending. It doesn't allow for us to address needs for capital spending, to address our preferred maintenance needs, and there are issues about the DPF. I think that it's important that we don't pass too tight of a spending cap in constitution, because it makes it very difficult for us to address the strategic needs that the state of Alaska has. So what we are proposing instead would be a statutory spending cut. And this bill needs work, and it's going to be very good. We have identified challenges in introducing this bill that I think are strategically very dangerous to the state of Alaska if the spending cap were to be passed in its current form. For example, the massive federal infusion of funds that was referenced that we're using $700 million in American Rescue Plan Act funds to offset DF in our operating budget this year. And if we were to set our spending cap based only on state spending, we would see this cliff in spending after the end. As a result of offsetting our GS by American Rescue Plan Fund. Because the bill is currently drafted, the spending cap is our 3-year average, is very similarly proposed to OMB. And there's probably a lot of other ways that we can make the spending cap bill better to allow for more flexibility. And I think that I would be proposing changes to the spending cap, and I would encourage members of this committee to propose changes to the spending cap as well to invite that discussion. However, we need to develop a comprehensive sustainable fiscal plan that allows for adequate funding of essential government services. And while I don't support passing the spending cap without a revenue measure, and I don't support a constitutional spending cap, I do believe that a more meaningful spending cap in this country is an important element as part of a broader conversation about passing a fiscal plan and stabilizing. And with that, I will invite Rev. Stolman, my chief of staff, to do a sectional analysis of this bill, and Thank you for the record, Lord Sparnold, staff to Representative Sparnold. Thank you for the opportunity to tell you in particular about 18-1 for your mind today. First, I'd like to move to the intersectional analysis, and then highlight some of the differences between this bill and Illinois HGR 6. Section 1 of the bill updates the existing statutory arbitration with the sound at AS37.05.5.3b. To update appropriations subject to this limit, to clarify which fiscal year appropriations are attributed to, and to provide the 3-year average adjuster to the appropriation limit. Section 2 of the calculation and reporting of the appropriation limit, the responsibilities of the governor under the Executive Budget Act. Section 3 retains language related to appropriations from the Budget Reserve Fund for Disasters, as this bill in Section 1 covers those appropriations and excludes them from the appropriation limit. Section 4 goes to Sections 1 and 2 of the bill applying for appropriations that are affected in fiscal year 23. Section 5 contains transition language clarifying that prior appropriations made for reimbursement and state declared disasters will not be included in the calculation of the appropriation limit for the fiscal years 23, 24, and 25. And Section 6 establishes the effective date of July 1st, 2021. Thank you, Governor Griswold. I have found the characterization map to highlight a couple of key differences between this bill and the HCR that we just heard. First, as Rick Sponsel mentioned, this is a statutory appropriation limit and not a constitutional limit. That's a major difference for obvious reasons. And the intent is to ensure that this appropriation limit works in practice before the legislature considers the rule of changing the Constitution. The second difference you can find on page 91B of House Bill 131, and that excludes on-net reimbursement from the appropriation limit. And the fact that I have is to treat school bond debt as any other type of debt that the student is liable for repaying. The final difference here is minor, but could be important. The current statutory limit refers to appropriations made in a fiscal year, and House Bill 131 would refer to appropriations made for fiscal year. Depending on the legal interpretation, it could be fine, but there could be some concern that some operating budget is typically passed in the prior fiscal year or the next fiscal year, so we just want to clarify that language. And if those changes, we might be happy to answer any questions. Thank you for that, and do you want to see any questions at this time? Perhaps.
Thank you, Chairman. For purposes of the discussion at this point, this is roughly the same amount of data as what was presented previously. And I appreciate the concern about putting something in the Constitution that kind of does make it in principle. Would it be possible, thinking out loud, maybe there's somebody here to answer the question, would it be possible to put this proposal or something like this for the voters, for the advisors? Or, I guess I could be waiting on spending.
Representative Brooks to the chair. Spending caps are very popular. But I have no doubt that if I think that a spending cap were voted on in an advisory vote by the public, it would pass. However, it's actually necessary for the statutory spending cap to go for a vote of us, the people, and given that we both know that the legislature has the authority to pass a statutory spending cap, and that it wouldn't even pass, it seems an unnecessary effort and expense to do that.
is you're proposing to exclude school broadband from this proposal. Is that correct?
Yes, Representative Thompson, the chair, we have proposed, this is Representative Harris Bottles, but we have proposed excluding school broadband, and that is because essentially voters across the state have voted to approve school bond debt, and therefore if this has ever been voted on by the people, we believe that that is an obligation of the state or our obligation to those local communities for our school bond debt.
Would that continue for new bonds?
Statutes in many places that were not, that the legislature isn't able to
see something on the books that we haven't changed. And I think that there's some merit to that, however, the risks of, the risk of taking something out and making something constitutional and having to take on this time to make sure that it actually works are so high, and it merits us calling out. And we have a really good point in this bill was the requirement that the Office of Management and Budget, that the administration says we're working on how their budget meets the statutory spending cap as proposed. And right now we have a statutory spending cap, but it's largely ignored. Nobody knows what it is, and there's no reporting as to nobody knows what how the spending proposals in this budget are compared. And we've seen, Democrats and Republicans alike, ignore the statutory spending cap because there's no reporting requirement. And there's another bill on the legislature on the other body, which would require the legislative financial analysts to report on how the budget proposal compares to the spending cap. I recognize that not on the front of those mechanisms. I think either will have merit and have value. But that's the reason we do the statutory spending cap.
I think that that argument is more narrow. I mean, it could be three environmental levels spending down, but that's just rather than usually it'll be down. Not irreversibly, but make it very difficult for us to have that flexibility to really find that we need it later on. And if, another solution that comes to mind is put the revenue really down. I mean, ultimately, what does seem to be a spending cap in some sense if we just because of us, because we are allowed, that's how much I have to spend, and I can't go beyond that, and I just don't have access to the rest of the money that the law has. With the spending cap, you look at a lot of these mechanisms, what we spent last year and the year before, and the year prior, predicting what we would spend today, not looking at what we actually have to spend, what we can sustainably spend. So, if I look at the PRB, for example, for the part of the Constitution, balances out and provides stability to revenues while also at the same time limiting the money that we have to spend and certainly the spending cap and then highlighting the situation I spoke to earlier where maybe double money comes in and that artificially reduces our budget and then under spending cap agreement will be found the next year. If the legislature decided to take advantage of that, if the money cap next year, if the legislature wanted to use that money, then
support spending cap without a bribe-based revenue measure? No, I wouldn't.
I'm uncomfortable with. I think there's some merit to that argument. And you've identified another issue, however, which is the 3-year-old average. Our last time I asked very much, but I think the floor is the problem. The bill as we've currently drafted it. And we started it based on, looking at the numbers that I talked about. If it weren't for settlement, the 3-year-old and average would make more sense. You could change adjusters to allow for more growth as a possible strategy. This committee could also rewrite it and instead of having a 3-year-old and average, it can establish a new floor. It can reset the floor of spending debt. There's a bill in the inner body that resets the floor at about $6 billion. Which would allow and that bill also includes PFD. So we actually have a lot of questions about policy calls. Regardless, anything that we do, I think should only be in statute so that the legislature can respond to important issues as they arise. If we put it in the Constitution, we absolutely hamstring ourselves. And we've certainly seen in both communities across the state of Alaska, where there's plenty of our own community representative trying to spend the time that is at times limited its ability to respond to needs. There was a real struggle in the municipality of Anchorage a few years ago finding funding for the police department. There had been a lot of pressure to limit the growth of government in Anchorage, and over time the police department staff was cut by police officers on the neighborhood by about 1/3, and that resulted in closing down over the years, which really frustrated a lot of different residents. And I share that concern. I mean, many in my neighborhood victims of crime, and I heard a lot about going knocking door to door, and it was their health cap in the municipality of Anchorage, which limited their ability to be able to invest in public safety, and they actually had to cut other programs for the municipality of Anchorage in order to be able to make those investments. And, I commend the assembly and the mayor for making those infrastructure choices to invest in public safety, but I think that's the risk that the risk will be forward by rolling into this paper.
Thank you. Thank you. Submit my answers and have a question.
Thank you. It's more or less just a comment. I really support the idea. And yes, I could see, I would prefer this, and perhaps that's what I'm saying. I could see this working and being a vast improvement, even if it was in statute, because the problem that I see with the budget development process, both here and when I was on the assembly, is that we just focused on all of the needs and wants first and siloed everything into a discussion without thinking about the overall picture of spending. So this would be a huge step in the right direction, and we should develop conservative confidence. So thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you for that, Will Briggs. I would just want to make a couple of comments. So, the issue you just brought up about the floor and about building the body to look at resetting the new floor and the three-year average is a concern that we have heard not just this week from Governor Johnson of the municipal league. Talking about the needs of some of our cities that are really struggling, the need to really look at are we helping with community assistance, keeping again our local municipalities strong, and also our public safety measures that you brought up. And so I think that is something that really needs. Looking at, and especially when I think about we've cut the budget 43% in how many years, and we haven't heard that some of our departments are really struggling to make these contributions that they asked for. And going to
Small wheelchair returns.
plan, which we hear is the 189, which is a committee bill establishing an education income tax in the state of Alaska. And we will actually be, it's very likely that we'll take up that bill next week on Tuesday. And so we've got some of the reasons from the committee this meeting is adjourned at 1 p.m.